This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Isabella Pittaway and I'm broadcasting live from the York Peninsula Field Days at Parskerville. It is absolutely great to be back here at the York Peninsula Field Days. I was last here in 2015 and again it was a lovely sunny day. On the show today we're going to get a bit of a sense of where the season's at on the York Peninsula given the rainfall we've had at the weekend. And also with me today broadcasting live from the Field Days is North and West Rural reporter Lucas Forbes.
Good morning, Isabella.
What else is coming up today?
We're going to be having a bit of a chat with the owner of Barley Stacks Winery about what's been going on in wine in York Peninsula, and they're also farmers, so we'll have a bit of a chat about that as well.
Excellent. And it's very timely that you talk about wine because that is actually what we're going to start with today, because the ACCC has released its final report into the wine grape sector and it has caused quite a divide in the industry. The Competition Watchdog's final report made 10 recommendations to address what it calls power imbalances between growers and winemakers. Australian Grape and Wine and the South Australian Wine Industry Association, or SOIA, have both condemned the report. Chief Executive of SOIA, Brian Smedley, says the findings will bring about negative consequences.
My understanding is that they are seeking warm climate buyers of wine grapes to actually be a bit more transparent in their pricing information by providing a mechanism whereby they have to report that to Wine Australia, and that can then get aggregated and sent back out as being pricing details for that particular company.
And do you think that winemakers should publicise that information?
Well, I guess the issue that's been raised is that in terms of how we've done it currently is really by providing indicative pricing. The ACCC has basically indicated that necessarily is not an appropriate way to be transparent. And I guess there's some evidence to suggest that may be the case, albeit that has been a feature of our industry for some time.
Yes, it does seem to be that some growers are signing contracts without even seeing that indicative pricing. What's the point if that is the case?
Well, I think the issue that needs to be raised in that respect is that if there are contracts in place, the first thing we need to be ensuring that people have something in writing rather than a handshake, which has been the nature and feature of our industry for some time.
There was data included in the report that was from 2014 that showed 94% of Riverland growers were actually operating at a loss. What's to stop growers from just throwing in the towel and pulling out of the industry altogether?
Well, I think you've highlighted the position in 2014. I think we're 5 years on. The industry is nowhere near what it was in 2014. Prices have recovered to a great extent. Many would say that the prices need to continue to improve, and that's probably true. But the issue about that is that was simply then, and this is now.
The report did indicate in that section that the ACCC believed that in 2018 it was still the case that growers were operating at a loss. You don't think that's the case then, that it's different from those figures in 2014 and 2018?
Look, I think there will be indications of businesses that will not be performing as well as they could, as there are examples of businesses that are doing very well. The key to that is to understand what are the differences and why are some businesses not doing as well as others.
Brian, Australian Grape and Wine have said that the ACCC have failed to understand the industry. Would you agree with that statement?
Look, I think in some of the recommendations, I think there is elements of that, and I think the proof of that will be in the fact that they've assigned or requested to assign various of the recommendations to various other entities to actually undertake work. So I think it will be an interesting situation to see whether, in fact, they have read the industry better than what we understand the industry to be.
Chief Executive of the South Australian Wine Industry Association, Brian Smedley. However, other groups have welcomed the ACCC's findings. Here's what Chair of Riverland Grape Growers Association, Brett Proud, told news reporter Laura Collins.
The wine grape market study has been quite thorough, and on balance, I think all the findings are quite valid. And I'm sure, you know, some sectors of the wine industry will have a little bit of angst in some of the findings, but on balance, I think the ACCC has listened to all areas of the wine industry, and the recommendations, I think, are fair.
What are you hoping they'll achieve for the industry and for the stakeholders within the industry?
Well, the most important thing about a successful wine industry for Australia is that it's sustainable for all sectors. So it needs to be sustainable not just for the people who make and sell wine, but it needs to be sustainable for the growers who grow the grapes to make the wine. So in the end, the whole process needs to be transparent and fair.
That is Chair of the Riverland Grape Growers Association, Brett Proud, and he was speaking to Laura Collins, and earlier you heard from Brian Smedley from the South Australian Wine Industry Association, and he was speaking there to Grace Whiteside. You are listening to The Country Hour. We're broadcasting live from the York Peninsula Field Days. We will be chatting to the owners of a winery on York Peninsula as well a little bit later on, but right now with me is Cynthia Axford, who is the site bookings officer for the Field Days. Hello and welcome to The Country Hour, Cynthia.
Thank you very much.
Now, first of all, like a beautiful day today. How are you feeling about how this is shaped up today?
Well, I've got to say that I am thrilled to bits with the weather. We were very worried last week. We had sand, dust storms everywhere. We had a beautiful rain, and now with the settled dust and the green grass, it's made everybody in a good frame of mind to come to a Field Days and have a beautiful family day out. And the crowd today, I would say, is almost double yesterday, and it always is Wednesdays. Wednesday's a great day.
And are you getting a sense from people, given that rain on the weekend as well, that there's a bit of a uplift in the mood? Or
There is. Like, it may not make a lot of difference to the bottom line last week to this week, but it's the mental side of things that helps us as farmers. We're very lucky to have had the rain, and people can hope that the grain will feel well, and we will get a nice heavy grain to take to the silos.
Now, the York Peninsula Field Days, they're held every 2 years, but they're actually the oldest Field Days in Australia, is that right?
That is right. We have a wonderful history, 125 years since our first Field Day, and we're very pleased to be, you know, still going long, strong, and work with our Eyre Peninsula Field Days, who will have theirs in August next year. And yes, we're 2 years, every 2 years.
And what do you think is different or special to the York Peninsula Field Days?
Look, it's about tradition a little bit. We're very lucky to have so many volunteers that can, come to the Field Days as bureau members, and they help to set the place up. And, you know, we just all pitch in and work hard. We all do, and I'm not too afraid to say, we worked really hard to put this on, particularly this year after losing our administration building in February. It's been a big year of building up, and hopefully we'll look at rebuilding that next year.
Was that through a fire? Or
yes, on the 8th of February this year, in the middle of the night or 3 o'clock in the morning, it was noticed that our building was on fire, and then of course it was found that it was a deliberate light and that it had been broken into. So it's very sad for us that we've had to clear that away and to have lost so much memorabilia. That's what we've lost.
Indeed. And also, though, to the strength, I guess, of the community and that committee, everyone coming together, you've pulled off what looks like a really good couple of days.
Yes. A lot of people asked me on the phones in the office, are you rebuilding this year? And we said, no, we need to think about it, licensed thoroughly about what sort of building to rebuild. We're not going to just make a quick decision on that. We need to be really thorough in our preparations for the future. And in spite of the setback, we've certainly put on a very good show.
Cynthia, thanks so much for your time today. I know you're really busy. You told me you haven't had breakfast, so please go and eat something for us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That is Cynthia Axford, very busy. She's the site bookings officer for the Field Days. As I said, it is the oldest Field Days in Australia, held every 2 years. And it is a very sunny day for us today at Paskerville. With me now, I'm joined by a couple of farmers who are no stranger to this area on Northern York Peninsula. I'm I'm with Nick Coral, who farms at
Kolpara.
Kolpara. Yeah. I'm glad you said the pronunciation there for me. And I'm also with Chris Maloney, who farms north of Arthurton.
Correct.
Welcome to you both. Let's perhaps start with something obvious but fantastic, and that was the weekend's rain. First of all, Nick, how much rain did you get?
Oh, we sort of had between 20 and 25 mils, and it's been perfect. Like, we couldn't, you know, ask any more than that. Things were really starting to go backwards, so to have that solid rain after such a rough day last Thursday has certainly turned things around.
And just what a bit of it, well, how much of a difference has it made to what you're doing?
Oh, well, I mean, before this rain, things were going backwards. We really didn't know how the season was going to finish. We've had reasonable amount of frost damage, and then the crops not having enough moisture to fill, so, well, it's worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And Chris, how about yourself? How much rain did you get on the weekend?
Yep, very similar to Nick. We're probably between 20 to 25 mils across the land that we're cropping at the moment. Definitely it seemed like a real get-out-of-jail card for us. I certainly hadn't seen it that previous to that rain. I hadn't seen it that dry in my 3 or 4 years I've been back on the farm. So it's, very, very helpful.
And you were saying potentially, like, before that rain, it was the driest, well, year to date to September that you'd ever seen.
Oh, certainly, yes. It was looking... things were going backwards pretty quickly, especially the wheat on canola stubble, where there wasn't much left underneath. And certainly the soil moisture probes have shown that we're riding by the skin of our pants, I suppose, most of the year. And that hot wind on that Thursday, I think, got to about 29 degrees, and some pretty steamy winds was moving things along pretty quick. So that inch couldn't have come at a better time, really.
I guess for both of you, what will it mean, I guess, now as you're getting ready for harvest later on in the year? How does this sort of set you up for the rest of the season?
Well, I mean, it would always be nice to get one more rain while crops are green and filling. You can, you know, still any rain's a benefit, but it will allow us to fill what's there and, maybe push the season out by another couple of weeks. So, the lentil crops will really benefit from it because they really don't need a lot of moisture until now, but they're all flowering and potting at the minute. So the more, if it stays a bit cool and... if we get a bit more moisture, well, they'll just keep filling. So I'd say the lentils would have gone from being not really yielding very high at all to now at least maybe, could be up to an average yield. So
game changer there for the lentils. And Chris?
Yeah, I probably agree. I think in the middle of the YP, we might have gained an extra 10 days or 14 days where it's still green. Certainly in the coastal areas where it's been a bit drier all year, I think it'll probably just allow a few more grain heads to fill and maybe get us closer to the average. But it was certainly a game changer, that's for sure.
And staying with grains, I guess one of the big things to happen this year is the announcement from the government that they were going to lift the moratorium on GM crops. Now, from my understanding, neither of you are currently growing canola at the moment, but with this decision from the government to lift the GM ban, where does that sort of leave you in thinking about canola, Nick?
Yeah, well, we've been fair weather canola growers, really. We sort of have grown on and off over sort of while I've been farming. But I think just maybe having access to that technology of being able to spray crops with glyphosate that might be something we look at in the future. Probably be good to see if it gets over the line for a year or two to see the agronomy of the crop. But I think it's something we'd certainly look at. And I just think that it's a good, that we are maybe going to be able to grow the crops because I don't really see that there's been a benefit by not being able to grow them. So, yeah.
Yeah, I probably agree with Nick. I think the moratorium has been quite frustrating for South Australian growers, especially over the last 15 years when we're watching our neighbours have the ability to use technology which is there. But especially frustrating for farmers because... continual improvements in productivity and efficiency is core value for what we do on a daily basis, and not having that ability to exercise technology which is there and proven has been very frustrating. So of course it's exciting news to see that the ban could possibly be lifted, and I think the role now is just to move forward and get on with it and basically give us the freedom to grow the crops that are required.
And is it something that you'll think about? I mean, you've just moved, well, a few years ago you moved back from Victoria to the family farm, Chris. Is that a discussion that you've had with the family about potentially, you know, growing GM canola?
Oh, of course. I think it's certainly got a fit for guys where their Group A chemistry is struggling in their canola and lentil and break crops and things. So it's definitely got a fit in certain situations for sure. So it'd be extremely handy.
Now, you're also part of the Emerging Leaders Program with Grain Producers SA, and you're going to be going on a professional development study tour in the United States and Canada next year. I guess, what are you hoping to sort of get out of that experience and bring back here to, you know, the York Peninsula?
Yep, so Caroline Rhodes and the GPSA team have put together this Emerging Leaders Program, which is essentially like a professional development program for a 12-month period with a number of workshops looking at improving communication and advocacy. And I suppose the international study tour is the biggest thing on the agenda. We'll be going to the USA to essentially to chat with guys over there about how they're what challenges they're coming across and what opportunities and how they're tackling them, and essentially just to try and take some learning from over there, bring it home to incorporate in our own farming systems and industry.
And what do you feel, I guess, the relationships between, you know, younger farmers coming up and what's the significance, I guess, of like having, you know, good communication between the younger farmers and older farmers and having programs like the Emerging Leaders Program?
Yeah, I think communication is king. Communication comes number one. You can't move forward if everyone's not on the same page. So I think, yeah, it's been one big learning that consensus doesn't generally work. You have to, or people have to move together in the one direction. So that was a big workshop we did a few weeks ago with Deanna Lush at Ag Communicators, which was all about improving communication and getting that message across and.
And on that, I think we were talking about before, actually, I think I was speaking to you on the phone and the phone dropped out. And I think that still goes to show, I guess, with telecommunications, just how far we've got to go in some aspects. And yesterday we were talking about the importance of data. I mean, just briefly from you both before we go, like, how much of an issue is that for you on the York Peninsula? Or do you think it's much better?
Oh, I don't. Well, yeah, well, of course, it's very important that we have fast internet and be able to make telephone calls and that quickly and for them not to drop out. So, I mean, speaking for myself, where we are, it's not too bad, but I understand there's plenty of areas where it is an issue, and these days you do all your business on your phone. So, no, it's very important going forward.
And how would you sort of rate the internet speeds and mobile coverage here, Chris?
Quite poor, especially where our home farm is, and then certainly a number of the areas in paddocks on the coast where we're operating, we have little to no reception, which is just an absolute roadblock, especially when you're thinking about technology adoption and thinking about fostering people, like, you know, fostering technology. It's very difficult to do that if you can't even get access to the internet. So I think that's probably like a priority number one, is to improve that telecommunications network throughout the state to move forward.
And I could see our next guest nodding along there at the start, so I feel like a lot of people would share that sentiment. Well, look, thank you both for joining me on the Country Hour, and here's to a good harvest.
Thank you.
That's Nick Correll from Kilpara and Chris Maloney, who farms north of Arthurton. You are listening to the Country Hour. We're broadcasting live from the York Peninsula Field Days at Paskerville, and it's currently 12:23.
Hello. In 23 days, there'll be an emergency and your house will be severely damaged.
Sorry.
We might have to move back in with Mum.
Even if you knew precisely when an emergency was going to happen, would you be ready? Emergency numbers in your phone? Insurance up to date? Red Cross has an easy plan to help you prepare for an emergency. Head to redcross.org.au/prepare.
And you're listening to the Country Hour. My name's Isabella Pittaway. We're live from the York Peninsula Field Days. I'm so happy to also see some people now gathering at the big blue shed here at Paskerville. And our next guest has actually brought a trophy with them. And I'm with the reporter Lucas Forbes as well. Lucas, who have we got here?
So we have from Barley Stacks Wines, York Peninsula Winery, Barley Stacks Wines, we have Lyle Schulz. Mr. Schulz, just tell us, what have you got in front of you at the moment?
Well, we're very fortunate. Thanks for having us on today. Very fortunate in the group that I also am involved in with the Y3P group, which is producers, like-minded producers on York Peninsula, food, wine, tourism, and other things like that. We've actually won just one best pavilion, and we're really excited about that. So if you're at the Larwood Pavilion and you're wandering up that way, come and have a look.
Fantastic. Now, just to paint a scene for me, most people might not think of the York Peninsula as really a wine region. Just how significant is Barley Stacks wine in the York Peninsula wine scene?
Well, the winery was established in 1995 by a gentleman who had a farm that thought he'd do something different, and that was Mr. Rod Gregory, who has become quite famous as the old fella that was on TV, the comedian that would go around and tell jokes. But going right back in the late 1800s, there was actually quite a lot of vineyards on York Peninsula, which a lot of people didn't even know about. And from what I understand, fruit was actually transported by ship from Ardrossan to Port Adelaide. But we took the business over from him in about 10 and a half years ago when we were operating his property, and he gave us the opportunity to buy the business.
And so just take me through, how many people do you get through through your cellar door in a year, for example?
Well, certainly the demographics for York Peninsula tourism have changed enormously in the last 2 to 3 years with the advent of craft breweries and distilleries. And this year we would expect over 5,000 people to go through our cellar door, which is a shed 2 kilometres up a dirt road. So we're getting a lot of people from not just York Peninsula, but predominantly from outside of York Peninsula. People seem to want to go and sit down and have a bit of a wine or a beer, or gin's very popular these days.
Mm. We did see a gin. We did see a gin stall on the way in, actually, as well. So might have to check it out as well. Now, the ACCC has released a report into the wine market at the moment. We spoke a little bit earlier off mic about this. Just tell me what, I suppose, have been your thoughts on some of its recommendations.
Well, I think one of the ones that we discussed is the actual testing of wine product. And having been involved in the hay industry for many years and trying to standardise testing of hay across not only the suppliers but also the purchasers to get a consistent confidence in what the testing results would give, I think from what we could see on that report that I only just read this morning, was that that's something they're definitely looking at as a high priority. And certainly from our point of view as a small winery, it doesn't probably impact greatly because our product isn't going overseas as much. But if I was buying a product that was virtually not cited, but you have to rely on the testing, you'd want to have some confidence in those tests.
And do you think there is much of a, while you don't export your wine, do you think there is a power discrepancy between the larger producers and the wine producers collectively, the smaller wine producers collectively?
Well, it certainly gives that sort of sense that when you read the report that there needs to be a coming together from the small producers, whether you're small or whether you're large, you have the same results and same consistency with reporting when those results are taken.
Now, you're also a farmer around here, a cropper, and so I suppose the question I have to ask you is, how's the rain been at your place?
Well, we have to say we've been very blessed. I was checking with my son earlier today with some of the results of our rainfall, and we've got records go back for over 100 years, and we're certainly in the... of 95 of those years have been well above what we've had this year. We've achieved 200 mils this year, which I know there'll be a lot of people would die to have. But then if you recall... back in 1959, in areas like that, at times like that, some of the worst droughts ever, and we were reaping 5 bushels, for those that remember what bushels were. This year, I still would expect that we're going to reap some pretty average crops within the central part of York Peninsula. The coastal areas have gone out pretty quickly, but if you weren't frosted and you weren't impacted by rain, you're still going to have some good results.
And just quickly before we go to news, now that you're, what's your the next priority for the wine part of your business at the moment?
Sell more wine.
Sell more wine.
Very good as a farmer. We're always good to grow it, but you've got to be able to sell it. So we're certainly looking to get our wine into wider areas, particularly into metropolitan areas. And we do send wine all over Australia through Australia Post, but we need to look at better distribution.
So you're looking at maybe more like those capital city sort of areas?
I think so. Being a smaller winery and inconsistent seasons, we don't turn out the same tonnes every year. We have ups and downs, but it's all about getting quality product out, and certainly we've been fortunate to get quite a number of awards for our wines now, and it's pleasing to see people coming through even today and yesterday recognising our brand and coming back, which we really appreciate.
Well, Mr. Schulz, thank you very much for your time, and congratulations once again on your win.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on. Everyone have a good day.
No worries. All right, Isabella, back to you.
Wonderful. And Lucas, we'll touch back with you a little bit later in the program, but you are off to the Sheep Pavilion.
I've got to dash that way to get to the Sheep Pavilion in time.
We'll talk to you soon. You are listening to the Country Hour, and you might have just heard the clip-clop sounds of another Clydesdale going past a little bit earlier here at Paskerville. It is 12:30, so let's find out what's making news headlines. It's good afternoon to Tim Jeans.
Good afternoon, Isabella. US President Donald Trump has slammed the launch of a formal impeachment inquiry into him as a witch hunt. He's been accused of trying to smear his political rival Joe Biden during a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart. Announcing the inquiry, Democrat House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the president must be held accountable, but Mr. Trump is describing the move as absolute garbage. Opposition parties in Britain are demanding the immediate resignation of Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who's been found guilty of breaking the law by suspending Parliament. 11 judges unanimously ruled as unlawful Mr. Johnson's move to suspend Parliament in the run-up to Brexit. And in the AFL, Port Adelaide ruckman Paddy Ryder has asked to be traded to St Kilda. Ryder's played 73 games for the Power after starting his career with 170 matches at Essendon. Port says it'll work with Ryder to negotiate a deal with the Saints. There'll be more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Tim. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau now and say good day to Vince Rollins. Hi, Vince.
Hello, Isabella.
Now, look, I've been speaking to some happy farmers with what rain they picked up on the weekend, but unfortunately, it doesn't look like there is much on the radar for the rest of the week.
No, certainly not. We're looking at pretty dry conditions over the next 7 days. Get a little bit around the lower southeast. It's probably the only place that's going to see any sort of, not really substantial, but, more than, a millimetre. So they'll probably see a little bit continuing today. We've already had a millimetre at Mount Gambier this morning. Got a bit of a little weak front going through that region again on Friday that could produce a bit. And then as we head into the week, the latter part of the weekend and early next week, there's a chance of a little bit more through that region. But generally elsewhere across the state, we're just looking at fine conditions. See temperatures picking up a little bit across the state tomorrow. We've got a high pressure system sitting to our east that's producing some northerly winds across the state. We do have a trough that just gets to the probably Nullarbor Plain area late tomorrow. So we'll see the northerlies continuing tomorrow, temperatures rising. But that trough moves across western south of the state during Friday. So ahead of the trough, we still see quite warm conditions with northerly winds, but once our trough goes through, we'll return to generally near average temperatures, maybe a touch cooler in some places, but we'll see some light winds overnight and pretty clear conditions. So as we head into the weekend, likely to see some more cold mornings and some areas of frost, particularly over eastern and central districts. And then as we head into next week, we get the ridge sort of strengthens a little bit. We start to see the winds go back round to the north. And then on Tuesday, we have another trough moves across the south and west of the state. So again, we go through that cycle where we start to see temperatures rising over most of the state. And then once that trough goes through during Tuesday into Wednesday, we see temperatures starting to cool. Looks like we'll see some pretty hot temperatures heading into the north and west of the state, so probably likely to see some temperatures getting to those mid-30s, perhaps some high 30s in a couple of places in the north, particularly in the sort of northwest of the state early next week. So yeah, pretty hot conditions for some areas heading our way. But yeah, as I said, pretty dry, not much around as far as rainfall goes, unfortunately. So we'll have to just wait and see what happens with the future weather patterns as to if we get any follow-up rain to what we've recently seen. So yeah, not much to speak of as far as rainfall, but certainly a typical sort of spring pattern with these troughs coming through where the temperatures just go on a bit of a roller coaster over the next few days.
Okay, Vince, we will wait, and I know how much another rain would mean to obviously everyone here, but we'll just have to wait and see there. You are listening to The Country Hour. Let's have a look now at the far west of New South Wales and get to your forecast. For the upper western district, tomorrow will be a mostly sunny day with overnight temperatures falling to between 6 and 10 and daytime temperatures reaching the mid to high 20s. And for the lower western district, a mostly sunny day as well for tomorrow. Overnight temperatures will drop to between 6 and 10, and daytime temperatures will reach the mid to high 20s. It's currently 26 minutes to 1.
This Saturday, ABC Grandstand takes you to the 2019 AFL Grand Final.
What a moment this is! What a goal!
Listen live as Richmond go head-to-head with Greater Western Sydney in their Grand Final debut.
GWS into their first Grand Final!
Who will take home the Premiership Cup?
What a game of footy!
The 2019 AFL Grand Final.
Live with ABC Grandstand.
On ABC Radio.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Where we are broadcasting live at Paskerville for the York Peninsula Field Days, a very sunny day today. Very soon we're going to be talking about a bit of ag tech, because I know that's a lot of things farmers come in and check out what is the latest in technology. But before we do that, the Arkaroola Wilderness Sanctuary is preparing for more wildlife deaths due to the drought. Last year, the sanctuary saw hundreds of animals die around watering points due to the drought. Manager Vicky Wilson says they've had to put out water and food to keep the animals going.
We've got actually a couple of different approaches. So there's a yellow-footed rock wallabies that have always been around the village. And we started off with Cato that we rescued, so we put out a bit of food for him, and then some of the others have been coming in. So we've set up a feeding and watering station. An ecologist friend built it for us. And so we give them a little bit of food every afternoon, and visitors get to see them, so they learn a little bit about the wallabies. And it just helps support those ones through the through this drought, which is, you know, something, you know, the Doug has never experienced a drought like this before, and he's been here for 46 years. The other approach is we've put some water pods out at three locations, and the wallabies out at those places, they don't get any food, but they get some water, and they seem to be doing okay as well.
Is there any risk that the wallabies might become reliant on you for resources?
I think at the moment they're very much like the food. They particularly like the wallaby pellets. But once we get some rain and some nice, you know, food, nice plants growing, they'll be right out. Like, as soon as there's flowers coming up, they absolutely adore flowers. And so when that happens, we'll tailor off the food and they'll be on their own again.
Now, can you give me an idea, how dry has it been there this year?
Well, as I said, Doug's never experienced a drought like this here. We've got several of the water holes that we thought were permanent are now dry, have been for a year and a half. What water's left in water holes is the few that are left. That water's really putrid. So it's just terrible. And we've got mature calitras dying off. We've got dead finish. Just to look around, it's just amazing to see the things that you thought would survive pretty much any drought are really, really struggling.
So even native wildlife plants are dying off.
Something like the dead finish, which, you know, I'd always thought was a sort of the last thing to go. There's some of those are really browning off.
That is Arkaroola Wilderness Sanctuary Manager Vicky Wilson speaking there with Lucas Forbes, who we will be catching up with shortly. He is on his way to the Sheep Pavilion. We will find out soon why. But right now, though, on the country, our water is obviously a really important issue at the moment, and field days are a chance for farmers to come along and, I guess, see what the latest there is in technology. So we're going to sort of combine both of those things right now, and I'm joined by Nick Bradley, who is the Business Development Manager at FarmBot. Welcome to the Country Hour, Nick.
Thanks, Isabella. Great to be with you.
First of all, can you just tell us a bit about what technology is currently out there for farmers when it comes to water monitoring and water management?
Sure. So, well, FarmBot in particular and other telemetry providers deliver near real-time remote water monitoring. So it gives people remote access, remote visibility of their water resources. And right now, to put things into perspective, we can deliver visibility around your water storages for less than $1.60 a day. So that's a material benefit to anyone who's managing livestock, who's monitoring water resources over long distances or even on multiple properties. So it's really improving productivity and profitability for farmers generally.
And have Australian farmers been early adopters of this technology compared to other farming systems around the world? And if that is the case, why has that been?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, obviously, being on the driest continent on the planet, it probably took us and maybe the Israelis, but we seem to be taking the lead on this. But, technologies like FarmBot are really appealing to anyone looking to drive those benefits, those cost benefits, commercial benefits. Reducing the amount of time and money they spend on travelling around checking waters and giving them that peace of mind. So they're probably the drivers, the peace of mind generally, and the reduced, fuel, vehicle wear and tear, that sort of thing, is why people are taking to it early and adopting it wholesale.
So the tech can tell you things like, if there's a leak and that sort of thing, and it can save you time in that sense. Is that what you're referring to?
Certainly, yeah. So when I first said that, FarmBot in particular, where we do event-driven technology. So what I mean by event-driven is that we tell you what you need to know when you need to know it. And that is indicating when there's a leak or a break. So you will get an alert via text message and email straight to your computer or your tablet or your phone telling you that, hey, you're losing water faster than you can afford to lose water, or your flow rates have exceeded a maximum amount, or if you're working with water under pressure going between bores and tanks or troughs, turkey's nests and so forth, it'll let you know when pressure drops out. So these are all, significant issues that people need to know about immediately, particularly in dry times like this. When you're losing water, you want to know about it ASAP so you can fix it, because it's a scarce commodity. And, with the unreliability of weather patterns these days, having that visibility and control and being able to address them immediately is also important.
You'd really need to have good connectivity as well to really get, the full advantage of this technology too. And I'm presuming that can be an issue if you're out on, a remote station.
That's right, yeah. So, look, there are different technologies out there. I can speak for FarmBot. We do both a cellular and a satellite option. So we work anywhere. We are comms agnostic. We monitor past releases around Cooper Pedy and the northernmost reaches of WA. If you can think of extreme and remote environments, we are operating in it already. And, we can do that at less than $1.60 a day, which is cheaper than you can even, start a car. So in terms of accessibility, it works anywhere. But for those people, a little closer to urban centres or regional centres, we have that cellular option. So anyone with 3G or 4G range, we cover those as well.
And I guess just lastly, very briefly, at field day events like this, what's sort of the main question you get asked from farmers?
Well, look, everyone's trying to drive productivity and profitability. So, they're looking to cut down on costs. Remote water monitoring is obviously on a lot of people's minds, and they walk past FarmBot and no doubt other operators in this area. But it represents an opportunity to save costs and generate more time. So the less time they're spending in a car checking water, the more time they have to either spend with family or work on capital improvements on the farm. But I've had a number of people coming up to visit existing customers. It's really interesting. They talk about using this technology to cut down on. I had a fella from Cooper Pedy come down. He was doing 1,400 kilometres a week in bore runs, and our telemetry has enabled him to reduce that to 350 kilometres. And similarly, a guy from Lucendale was saying he's got a property in Port Fairy, and he just wants to have that peace of mind and visibility around that second property in Lucendale in Port Fairy. So you know, it's hearing these things and knowing that the positive impact and the financial benefit, not just financial either, it's the peace of mind. They're able to sleep at night and spend more time with their families.
Nick Bradley, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Isabella.
That's FarmBot Business Development Manager Nick Bradley. You are listening to The Country Hour. My name is Isabella Pittaway. We're live at the York Peninsula Field Days. And right now, let's head off to the Sheep Pavilion and say hello again to Lucas Forbes. Hey, Lucas.
Hey, Isabella.
What's happening?
Well, I'm just joined at the moment. I want to find out more about the junior sheep judging and the Wool Pavilion in general. I'm joined by the convener of the Wool Pavilion, Caroline Johnson. G'day.
Hi, how are you going this morning?
And I'm joined by ag teacher from Kadena Memorial School, Charlie Benson.
Hi, it's nice to join you.
So I suppose I just want to start with you, Ms. Johnson. You actually have a very special connection with this with the shed here. Could you just mind telling me about that in your own words, please?
Sure. I'm the daughter of the late Murray Allen, which the Sheep and Wool Pavilion is named after, and both my parents, Murray and Rose, were very passionate about the importance of promoting the wool and sheep industry, but also having an educational focus so that the young people of the area could understand the job opportunities and the things that they can develop and learn about the sheep industry, whether they're going home on the farm or want to join a shearing contracting team, being a shearer or a shed hand, that there's so many different opportunities, and it's such a significant part of our economy that you know, a lot of people just don't know enough about it.
And I suppose part of that is the junior sheep judging, which is on today here at the Pasky Field Days. Could you just mind telling me a bit about what you can tell me about how that competition's going so far today?
Well, we're very fortunate that we've had our local school, Kadena Memorial School, come and support us, but we've also had a few other people come past. But the junior fleece and sheep judging is designed to, one, train future judges for country shows, but also to teach students confidence in animal selection and comparison, and gives children or students, you know, confidence in wool classing, you know, in the shearing shed and things like that. So it's a very important skill that students need to have to be successful in Year 12 to get into the A band, that they need to be able to evaluate and compare and critique and justify their reasons. So it's a really good way to develop those confidence in those skills, and to be able to either go back into the industry and select rams confidently, class ewes confidently, home on the farm, or you know, help out in supporting industries.
And Mr. Benson, how many students have you brought from Kadena today?
Well, we've got around about 22 or so students that have joined us. However, good thing about our school is that we sort of support the field days by having the second day as a school closure day, because obviously it's going to be quite impossible to get kids to remain in school while we've got an event like field days on. So we actually close the school for the second day of field days. All the kids come out, and I've got a team of around about 20 to 22 students who we've been sort of going over a few fleeces, practicing on some sheep in preparation for entering in the sheep and wool judging competitions.
And I suppose, how does the junior sheep competition and sort of practical experience like that, how does that reflect into the agricultural classroom?
That's a big part of our school curriculum, is the sheep components. Our local area is mainly sheep and grain production. It's largely about getting kids to sort of see different types of sheep, particularly those of a stud. We're very fortunate, of course, that Caroline comes from a stud herself, that she brings some high-quality sheep for students to see. So it's really important that students not just get experience in terms of educational aspect with their sheep, but also that they're seeing the best that, you know, the wool industry and the sheep industry, the merino industry, sorry, I should say, has to offer for our students.
Fantastic. Well, it seems like there's a lot of activity around the pavilion, so I say you've both done a pretty good job of getting young people interested or involved in learning more about the wool industry. But Ms. Johnson, Mr. Benson, thank you both very much for your time.
Not a problem. My pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
All right, Isabella, that's me back at the Wolf Pavilion. I'll be over to the studio in just a second, but back to you.
Wonderful. Thanks, Lucas. We'll welcome you back shortly. And great to hear that preparation for the next generation of wool growers. It is, we're getting closer to 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour. And yesterday we heard about the six Bs, and it was all about men getting together to have a chat and support each other through tough times. So that was blokes, Barbie, beers, bull, .. You fill in the blanks there, and I'm probably forgetting a couple of the other Bs. But today we're going to hear about a group that's helping women getting through tough times and also just creating, you know, connections on the land. Mindset coach Hayley Grosser is from Caniva, so she's had a bit of a trip to be here today on the York Peninsula. And Hayley has set up a social media group called Empowering Women on the Land, and it's all about creating a supporting space where women can connect and talk about the highs and lows that come with farming. And she joins us now on the Country Hour. Hi, Hayley.
Hi, Isabella. How are you going?
I'm great, thank you. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about the group and how it started?
So Empowering Women on the Land actually started from a tough time that I was going through a few years ago. And so I felt that if I was going through it, then there would be other women also going through it on the land. So it was about sharing my experiences so that others would feel like they weren't alone anymore and that they could feel there was a space that they could share the highs and lows that were farming.
And how do you go about doing that, making people feel comfortable and having that trust and feeling like they can open up and there is that supporting network available to them?
And I think it's leading by example. So by me sharing my vulnerabilities, I then allow other people to also share theirs. So if they can look at me and see that I'm just an ordinary person who is also going through those struggles, then they can feel more confident that they can step out also.
And what are, I guess, some of the, you know, vulnerabilities or issues or concerns that, you know, women in these group raise about being on the farm?
So a lot of it is about being really busy and feeling overwhelmed. So they're constantly doing so much, and being farmers and farmers' wives, they've got all of these extra expectations on them of how they should be doing things as well. And we're also combining that with life and children and community and financial stresses on the farm and seasons, that it's all just intermingled.
And does it leave people thinking, you know, how can I juggle all of this and balance it?
Absolutely. And I think people think that they need to do it themselves. They need to show that they've got it all together, when realistically no one really does. And so I think they feel if they're not got it all together that's a weakness, but really it isn't.
And what are some of the things that you're hoping to achieve or teaching or providing, I guess, through this group to help, you know, women through those feelings?
So for me, it's really about helping women strengthen their mindsets. So mindset is really imperative to life. And what your mindset is the perception that you see in your world. So I'm really helping women strengthen that mindset, and so they can go through adversity and tough times with a much stronger and more positive outlook, which then ripple effects out to their whole family.
And how many women are a part of the group, and whereabouts, you know, are they based?
So there's about 450 people, women in the group, and they're based all over Australia.
And how do you sort of, I mean, I guess one of the challenges is if you're out, you know, in remote areas just trying to feel connected to people, how are you hoping or trying to bridge that?
And it's really through the group. So it's really through me putting myself out there and other women actually seeing that and then being attracted into the group. And so I think social media, even though it has its downside, for something like being able to connect with other women, especially from rural areas, it bridges that gap. So it's about women, you know, actually looking for those spaces, because there are a lot of spaces online now that can provide support.
And just briefly before I let you go, you've travelled over from Caniva in Western Victoria and you're now here on the York Peninsula. I mean, what are you sort of noticing some of the differences on the road?
There's a big difference contrasting crops between here and there. But other than that, like it's fairly similar, like between the two places.
And Hayley, if anyone wants to find out more about Empowering Women on the Land, it's on Facebook. Is there anything else they should know?
They can visit my Facebook site, which is just under Hayley Grosser, and in there is the link to the Empowering Women on the Land group.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for letting us know about it today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Mindset Coach Hayley Grosser from Caniva in Victoria. And that Facebook group, again, is called Empowering Women on the Land. It is 6 minutes to one. Let's head off to the markets now. And first up, here's John Traeger with the Sheep and Cattle Report.
Good afternoon. More new season's lambs came forward as agents offered 9,000 lambs and 3,000 sheep to the usual array of trade and processor buyers, especially butchers, and a good field of restockers. Quality improved over the previous offering with more young lambs of medium to heavier weights, and with some aggressive competition evident, early sales of new season's medium and heavy weights lifted by from $10 to $15 per head. The trend eased mid-sale to be up 5 to 10, with more light merino types maintaining a firm to slightly easier trend under good restocker competition. Older lambs of lighter weight sold firm with medium weights up $10 a head, with the heavy weights reflecting a similar trend as more sales were made over $200 per head. Hoggets of all weights eased up to $15 a head as the varied selection trended from $80 to a top of $162 per head. Mutton prices also retreated, with an average drop of $10 per head, with rams of all weights remaining firm on the previous sale. Light young lambs range from $100 to $150, medium trade weights sold from $142 to $158, with the best of the heavyweights receiving $170 a sale top of $222 per head. Light older lambs sold from $82 to $127, medium weights received $166 to $194, with a few extreme heavyweights selling from $198 to $222 per head. Hoggets range from $80 to $168 on a wide range of type and weights, while light mutton sold from $56 to $135, with the heavier weights receiving $120 to $180 per head. Light rams sold from $94 to $120, with heavier rams receiving $120 to $136. And meanwhile, in the cattle market, cattle numbers remain similar, and quality was again extremely mixed. However, some ideally finished younger cattle came forward as agents offered 650 live weight cattle and 90 open auction calves, with the usual trade and processor buyers joined by feeders, restockers and specialty butchers. With only a few exceptions, the sale returned a mostly firm trend for type and condition on the previous sale results. Competition was generally good, with more competition coming from feeders and restockers throughout the offering. A generally good selection of yearless steers traded from 260 to 314 cents, while light heifers returned 246 to 270, medium weights made 240 to 300 cents, with choice heavyweights selling from 240 to 260 cents. Medium weight yearling steers sold to feeders and restockers from 278 to 304 cents, with heavyweights to the trade receiving 270 to 318 cents a kilo. A wide range of weights and types saw light yearling heifers selling for 170 to 254 cents, with medium and heavy weights receiving 240 to 290 cents a kilo. Grown steers ranged from 164 to 290 cents, with grown heifers selling from 168 to 290 cents. A limited number of heavyweight manufacturing steers sold from 210 to 234 cents. Light cows sold from 126 to 160. Medium weights received 158 to 230 cents, with heavy weights making 212 to 246 cents a kilo. Light bulls treated from 188 to 220 cents, with heavy weights to the trade receiving 190 to 254 cents. This is John Traeger at the South Australian Livestock Exchange for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks, John. Nice, decent back-to-back markets there. Let's head to the southeast now. Here's Peter Kerr.
Good afternoon, Isabella. This is the Mount Gambier Cattle Report for the 25th of September. Numbers fell sharply. Agents yarded 641 head of live weight and open auction cattle, with a fall of over 300 head on the previous sale. These sold to a smaller field of trade and processor buyers, with feeders present and active, while restockers had little impact on the market. Quality and condition fell away on last week's offering with a very mixed pending of cattle, with the rates being paid also easing. A small number of yearlers came forward, steers selling to 285 and heifers 278 cents a kilogram. Yearling steers were very small in number, the trade operating here from 235 to 294, feeders from 264 to 288. Yearling heifers to the trade fell 10 cents, they range from 267 to 289, some feeder support from 225 to 290 cents a kilogram. Growing steers and bullocks eased 8 cents as they range from 276 to 322, while the growing heifers range from 218 to 290 as a run of mainly dairy bred manufacturing steers eased 10 to 20 cents to range from 180 to 272 cents a kilogram. Heavy cows returned from 228 to 272 as the lighter selection ranged from 110 to 224 as bulls ranged from 228 to 300 cents a kilogram. This has been Peter Kerr for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Peter. And there's about a minute to go until we hit the news, but it has been absolutely fantastic broadcasting live from the York Peninsula Field Days at Paskerville. It's been 4 years in between drinks for me anyway, but Lucas, your first time at the YP Field Days?
My first one. A year and a half now, so I've missed it, but this has been amazing so far. This is just like watching a village pop up in the middle of York Peninsula, which is that's pretty much exactly what it is.
And a sense of optimism over at the Sheep Pavilion?
Very much so, yeah. I think a lot of people are feeling very very optimistic. And there was, like, we saw that VR farm project that people might have heard about in the mornings program, teaching young people how to navigate a field day, navigate agriculture. So it's been really fascinating.
Next Generation is in good hands. It's been great being here at York Peninsula at Paskerville. We are coming up to news time. It's 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.